the athletic trainer came out to me, and he's like, "Are you okay? Like, how are you feeling?" And I like had finally opened my eyes, because I like obviously my face was just clenching because it hurt very bad, and I saw like, might get a little graphic, like blood running from my nose, and I was like, "Man, I'm definitely not finishing this game."
Welcome to another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to current Dodgers right-hand pitching prospect Pat Copen, the rare current player appearing on this feed. Pat enters this season as the Dodgers' 20th-ranked prospect, according to BA, following a season where he led the organization in strikeouts across two levels, topping out at AA Tulsa. That would be an impressive enough stat, but what's incredible about Pat is that the 2025 season was his first following a traumatic injury. In August 2024, he was struck in the face by a line drive, which caused him to lose eyesight in his right eye. In less than a year, he rebounded from that injury to make his case as a guy who looks like a big leaguer. However, there's a lot more to Pat's story than just that injury, as we talk how professional pitching development and expanding his repertoire led to him cutting his ERA by over 2 runs from his junior season at Marshall to his first professional season. It's a fun episode for the pitching nerds, as Pat gets deep into pitch creation, trial and error with grips, and strategy. I'm really glad he stopped by the show, and I'm going to be rooting for him this year. Episodes from Phenom to the Farm drop every month. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. This is going to be our last episode before the season starts. You're going to be checking out the prospect hot sheet, everything going on in minor league baseball. As always, it is always a good time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Pat Copen. All right, joining in for today's episode of Phenom on the Farm, he was a 7th-round pick out of Marshall in the 2023 draft, current Dodgers right-hander, Pat Copen. Pat, thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. Mutual friend of ours, John Perrin, previous multi-time guest of the show, connected us. I wanted to start off with, you're living every man's dream. You have incredible flow. You have, this is not a video podcast, but you have the hair down to the shoulders. If you watch any of your pitching videos, it's flying everywhere. I have to, as someone who has kept it short and tight for a long time, what is the care that goes into maintaining hair that looks good?
I'd say probably number one thing is having a wife that knows a lot more about hair care than you do and listening to what she says. So
that's me, but with skincare.
Right.
That is
right.
Just tell me the products, tell me when to put them on, tell me how to put them on, and we're good.
Yeah, you're with that. I mean, we're kind of living life on easy mode with that aspect of it.
100%. So we're going to get into your entire career, your story, but you are right. We're recording this kind of right towards the tail end of spring training. Curious, as someone who was in big league camp, still minor league camp, like, curious, what is the day to day like? Like, what is your typical minor league schedule as far as getting your work in?
Everyone usually gets there between 7, 7:30. You eat your breakfast, and you get changed into your gear. And then we usually have 4 different pitcher groups, kind of depending on like when your next game is or like when the last time you threw. And they're also kind of split up into like potential teammates. We'll stretch like 20 minutes apart, starting at 8:30, and go, 8:30 to 9, and then 9:30 and 10, and just kind of like, depending on what group you're in, you get your stretch in, and then you go to like our massive little plyo wall, and get your plyos and your water bags and whatever drills you've been prescribed by the coaches, get your throwing in, and then after that you head to the weight room. You've got, if you've got like a lower body lift, you get that in, upper body, maybe like a stability circuit, something like that, and then free to get some treatment or do some recovery stuff, and then get lunch and hit it if you're not in the game.
Is every bit, because we're going to get into this when we talk about coming into the Dodgers system and changing your repertoire, but is everything like managed down to these are the stretches you're doing today, this is the workout you're doing today, this is the plyo work you're doing today, or do guys have kind of the freedom to do what, what I guess feels comfortable?
We have like a, individual prescribe like a prep plan, which is, kind of like the mobility stuff that we do before, like the dynamic warm up. And then we dynamic as a pitching staff. And then the plyo drills and all that stuff are individualized. It's kind of like a like recommendations where, you can do that. You can do like these drills, but if you're feeling something else, maybe like your arm's not feeling great, you can go lighter. Or if you want to get extra work in off of the mound or whatever, you can do that. They're kind of lenient when it comes to like drill work for plyos and water bags and stuff, just because, we the athletes know our body the best and kind of have that feel aspect where coaches really don't.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's fascinating. It's always interesting to hear how guys train. But I want to take it back to your upbringing. You are a tall drink of water, as they say. You are listed at 6'6". With that, I'm curious, like how quickly did you grow? Have you always been the tall guy? And then how did that affect you in terms of developing a pitcher? We always hear with tall pitchers, lot of limbs, lot of getting stuff in sync, and like curious, were you an early developer or kind of a late bloomer?
I was always tall. I just kind of like started out tall and, kept growing with everybody else. There was a few guys who were like really tall in like the sixth grade. And I was being the tall guy, I was like a little jealous. I was like, man, why am I not that tall? But then it all came out in the wash. They kind of stopped growing around ninth or 10th grade, and then I just kept going. I was like 6'3" in ninth grade, and I was like, man, I hope I'm not this tall for the rest of my life. But I gained a few more inches. So yeah.
When did you kind of realize that you were going to have a chance to play college baseball? Like when did the recruitment process start for you?
It was after my sophomore year of high school baseball. I was playing, like the summer ball, and it was after one of the practices, one of the coaches called me, or like called me over after practice, like, hey, like I got to talk to you. I was like, did I do something wrong? Like, did I get in trouble for something? And he was just like, I got a text from the Marshall pitching coach saying that they wanted to offer you a scholarship to go pitch there. And I was like, they can't even talk to me yet. He's like, yeah, that's why they're texting me. No, that I was living on cloud nine for like a month. But yeah, it was definitely surprising that a Division one school reached out even before a D2 school did.
So yeah, they were in on you early too.
Yeah, I don't really know like where they saw me or like what had happened, but yeah, they were in very, very early, and they kind of stayed, pretty persistent. Not like hounding me to commit or anything like that, but just, creating a relationship and stuff like that, which I appreciated a lot. There were some other schools that recruited me that, tried to hound me to commit early, or, were trying to like lowball me, I guess, and like, tried all these workaround stuff, but they were, pretty fluid and open about, how the whole process worked. And, I really enjoyed that part.
How many visits did you take?
It took four? Yeah, four.
And so, did you, when you left Marshall, did you feel like, oh yeah, this is definitely the place, or were you still waffling back and forth?
When I went in to Marshall, like driving into the city, I was like overwhelmed. The first thing you see for when you're driving in is the massive football stadium, and I'm like, oh my God. But walking around and watching a little practice and all that stuff, I was like, you know what, like I definitely could like see myself here for sure. I can definitely navigate the campus and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of kept my mind open because I didn't want to close myself off to something that could be better, that might pop up in the future or whatnot. But I definitely could see myself going there, the as we were driving home. But yeah, it was definitely the best option for me at the time.
And you were a COVID senior year kid, right? Like
Correct,
your
yeah.
COVID way. So walk me through the process of that, because obviously I presumably your senior year gets canceled pretty early if no baseball at all. How long did you go before pick like having a team practice again. Like, did you guys start right away at Marshall? Were there still like weird restrictions? Like, kind of walking through the introduction to college baseball when it's like everyone's kind of coming back to campus for the first time.
Yeah, it was definitely. I mean, obviously, I didn't know any different being, you know, a freshman. But, you know, it from what the older guys were said that it was, you know, absolutely insane. But, you know, when COVID first started, it was like we had one practice indoors when the entire season got canceled. But my dad and some other, you know, baseball guys around the area wanted to like try to find a way to play throughout the summer just because, you know, why not? Like, if we can do it, like, let's do it. And so we played like a few local like Legion ball teams throughout the summer, which, you know, super laid back, chill, just, you know, getting some innings in, playing some games, having fun. But yeah, there was like no restrictions on like how many people you could have on the team that year. So first practice I walk in and there's like 52 guys. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is going on right now? But yeah, it was like kind of one of those things where like I was so overwhelmed to where I just was like, I just have to do my own thing or else I'm going to get lost. So I, you know, just kind of like made buddies with my roommate. And I was like, hey man, like we were both from like smaller schools. And so, you know, we kind of just like bonded and we're like, let's throw together every day and let's just get our work in and, you know, not be worried about all the other stuff going on. Let's just do what we're supposed to do and get through this.
So I'd imagine the fall was a large, like kind of like weeding out process or figuring out like who's going to play, who's going to stick around. I mean, college baseball is always like that to a certain extent. Like you could have a fall where you know, you've got 35 guys, but 52 is insane. When did you start to figure out like, okay, I'm going to have a chance to be a contributor as a freshman? Cause that's 52 guys is a lot of guys to like share inter squad innings and figure out roles. Like that's extremely challenging.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my thought process through the whole thing was like, I wasn't going anywhere. Like if I was going to go to a different school, Marshall was going to tell me to leave. And I, you know, I didn't want to let that happen. So, you know, I, you know, did the work that I had to do and, you know, listened to the coaches and all that stuff. And, you know, there wasn't really anything that kind of like upset me. Like I understood that I was a freshman and there was like 13 other freshmen. So like, I was probably going to get kicked around, you know, I was going to have to carry the equipment and fix the mount and all that stuff. And like, I knew it was coming. Yeah, I just kind of like, just did what I had to do. And, you know, as a freshman, I figured that I was going to get a lot of help from the pitching coach and, you know, maybe from the older guys to like kind of turn myself into a college pitcher that could contribute. Cause you know, that was my main goal, was like, I just want to pitch as much as I can my freshman year and just learn as much as possible. And you know, it worked out pretty well and I'm pretty happy with, you know, how I developed that year for sure.
Curious, what kind of pitcher were you in college? Like your BA draft scouting report as a guy who threw your fastball 74% of the time, as we're going to get into it, you have a very diverse pitch mix at this point. So like what was kind of your personal mantra when you stepped on the mound at Marshall?
Throw your fastball because not a lot of guys can hit it. That's what my college coaches told me. And, you know, that's what I did in high school. So that's what I did in college. I had the curveball that if it was in zone, it was, you know, amazing. If it wasn't, then I was just like, whatever. I didn't really know about a lot of the, you know, inner workings of how to pitch as far as, you know, locating and stuff. But, you know, I knew that, you know, I could get swing and miss with my heater at the top and, you know, curveball at the bottom. And I knew where the strike zone was. So I just, you know, worked with what I had, I guess.
You were a guy who you contributed as a freshman, started as a sophomore, went to the Cape after your sophomore year. You guys were, I believe, under 500 your 3 years at Marshall. Curious, as someone who was like going to college in the transfer portal era, you were clearly a draftable player. There were probably other teams that would have had you. Like, did portaling out? Like, what is the conversation around a team when, you know, in April, you know, you're not making a regional unless you win the conference tournament or something like that? Like, does that, can that, like, can that infect a team, that concept? Because, like, now you can just leave. You can just portal out and find another place to go. Like, did that ever cross your mind?
There was inklings, I guess. You know, there were summer ball coaches that had connections that would be, you know, kind of be like, hey, by the way, if you were thinking about maybe entering the transfer portal, there would be a specific team with a specific conference that would have interest. You know, they would kind of be very vague about it and all that stuff. And I, like, there was a, you know, a lot of unknowns with transferring. Definitely, like, it was something that kind of overwhelmed me at first. And, you know, I just kind of couldn't get past that, like, initial overwhelming feeling. And, you know, I knew the coaches, I knew my teammates, you know, I knew how, you know, the fall worked. I knew how the winter worked and, like, how the spring games worked and all that stuff at Marshall. So I was, you know, very comfortable to, you know, get better and also, like, help my team win games. So I felt like I was in a pretty good spot at Marshall.
What was your takeaway from the Cape? Because it's, you know, it's not as though you were coming one of those guys who comes from, like, a D2, D3 school as a pop-up. But, like, you're coming from a G5 school. You're playing against guys who are at Vandy in Florida and Texas and all that thing. Like, did you come away with confidence from the Cape? Was that also an overwhelming experience? Like, here's, like, takeaway as a one-time Cape guy.
Yeah, I wasn't there for very long, but from, you know, when I was there, it, you know, kind of gave me some confidence. Like, I'm playing against guys who are going to get drafted in the 2022 draft. Like, I can definitely perform in minor league baseball. And then once I get to minor league baseball, you know, you have some of the best baseball minds in the world down there developing guys, trying to get them to the big leagues. Like, I can soak all of that in and, you know, climb my way up. And, you know, believe it or not, that's what I'm doing right now. But I definitely, you know, had confidence. Just like, you know, how my stuff performed against, you know, some of the best hitters in college baseball.
With the benefit of hindsight now and the couple years you've had in the Dodger system, you are the kind of rare guy that your pro numbers are significantly better than your college numbers. You had high strikeout college numbers, but it seemed like success varied at times. Like, curious what was, you know, if you could look back at, say, your 21-year-old self, what was kind of holding you back from reaching the success that you've had in the minor leagues at Marshall?
Yeah, I think just kind of figuring out, you know, how, you know, my pitches moved for starters, you know, and understanding that, you know, I have a strong supination bias. You know, forever in high school and in college, I was trying to throw a changeup and all my coaches were telling me, you know, get over top of it and roll it over, like, thumb down when you throw it. And I just could never do it. And I thought, I was like, it's like, I just can't throw a changeup. And then the player development at the Dodgers were like, no, you can't throw a traditional changeup because you're supination bias. I was like, oh, okay, that makes way more sense. And then they're like, you can't really throw a good changeup, but look at all these other great pitches. You could throw a bullet slider, cutter, sweeper. You know, you already have your curveball. Like, you can do all of this other stuff that is just as effective, just moves a different way. And, you know, kind of opening me up to, you know, how my throw works, how the ball comes out of my hand and, you know, what that means, kind of helped me understand, like, all of the pitches that I could throw, all the weapons that I could have, and, you know, how to use them correctly.
I do want to dive in deeper on that, but I want to hear about your 2023 draft experience as well. Heading into it, did you have like an indication of, okay, these, if I'm going somewhere, like, these are the teams, like, did you, you know, I'm sure you had a number in your mind or some sort of, but, like, how did you prefer that? And what was the, what I imagine didn't feel like a very short wait to the seventh round?
Yeah, it was pretty streamlined. You know, I had a handful of phone calls with, you know, multiple people in my agency at the time just to discuss, like, how it's going to go, what's going to happen. And then the day before the first round, they called me and they're like, hey, like, we've got, you know, confirmation, like, these X number of teams are want to take you 7 to 10. These X number of teams want to take you 10 to 13. Like, we're going to try to get you as high as possible. It's like, that works for me. And come, right after the Dodgers' fifth round pick, my agent called me and he was like, "Hey, the Dodgers want to take you in the sixth round." And I was like, "Sweet, sounds good." And then they didn't. So I called my agent. And I was like, "Hey, man, what the heck just happened?" And he was like, "Oh no, it's fine. They just decided to go somewhere else. They're going to take you in the seventh for sure. I'm going to see if someone wants to snipe you before to get you a little extra money." I was like, "All right, cool." And then they just took me in the seventh round, and that was that.
Just done deal. So you get into the Dodger system. So now this is where I want to dive in deep. What is the, 'cause there's all this reporting on, you got into the system, they overhauled your repertoire, told you these things that you kind of indicated. What does that process look like? Like, are you signing, heading to Arizona or heading to the facility and having this comprehensive sit down where they're like, "Let's trial this stuff," or do they send you out and let's figure it out there? Like, what goes into overhauling your repertoire? Was it something where they told you, "Okay, you're gonna start based on the analytics we have, everything, you're gonna start throwing these pitches," or was it more of a trial and error, like, "Try this on, see if it fits. Try this on, see if it fits"?
Yeah, it was definitely like trial and error. And the first thing that they did was like movement patterns, trying to fix movement patterns. A lot more like T spine, flexion extension, because I was super rotational. They wanted to get me, a little bit more north south, just to keep my my throw and my misses over the plate, all that stuff. But yeah, I would like. Would be throwing a bullpen, and one of the coaches behind me would be like, "Hey, man, like, throw a two seam." And then, I throw one. They look at the track man and be like, "Try this grip." And I throw one, and it would take off arm side. And they're like, "Keep throwing that next few days. See what you think." And then I got a one seam, runner. And then they're like, "Hey, I want you to take this grip, and I want you to throw it like a curveball." And I'd throw it like a curveball, and it just take off and go left. And I was like, "That was cool. What happened there?" They're like, "That's a sweeper. Like, try to replicate that." And that's just kind of how it went. A lot of like, it was obviously wasn't that easy. Especially with the sweeper, I tried probably seven different grips before it finally clicked. But yeah, it is a lot of like trial and error, and a lot of just like, grab this and see what happens.
So as of today, which is March 19th, 2026, how many pitches are in there? If you were pitching on the show, how many buttons would we need?
I'd be rocking six.
So if you go into a start with six pitches, divvying out that arsenal and deciding what you're gonna do that day, because there are guys who are two pitch guys, three pitch guys, whatever. Is it how you're feeling in the bullpen today? Like, "Hey, the sweeper's ripping today. Like, feel really good about that. Gonna throw the hell out of that today." Or something's not feeling great. We're scratching it. Or is it a mix of like, "We're gonna do this for certain hitters, do that." Like, how do you decide going into the game, "This is my ideal pitch mix for this game"?
Yeah, I have two, sometimes three pitches that I only use for a lefty or a righty, just because if I were to throw it to the opposite handed in which I use it, it probably wouldn't play very well. So like the cutter I only use to lefties, and the two seam I only use to righties, just kind of get in on the hands, break some bats, all that fun stuff. And then obviously the four seam is kind of like the primary pitch, and then my short bullet slider is mostly for righties, just kind of like a strike stealer, kind of just to keep them off the two fastballs. And then curveball and sweeper I use the same sides mostly. Mostly the sweeper is mostly like an advantage counts, trying to get swing and miss. And then the curveball is either or. It's either like early count strike stealer, or I'll rip a heater above the zone 0-2 and then tunnel it with a curveball down, and usually can swing and miss off that too.
I'll be honest, this summer is stacked. Between that one big international soccer tournament, America's 250th anniversary, and the Route 66 centennial, people are going to be traveling. What a lot of folks don't realize is that taking a trip in an RV is a whole heck of a lot more enjoyable than TSA lines or stodgy hotels. And you don't even have to own an RV or drive one to take part. With Outdoorsy, you can rent an RV or camper almost anywhere in the country. You can drive it, tow it, or have it delivered and set up for you. And these aren't bare-bones setups. Many come with full kitchens, bathrooms, showers, and real beds. It's often more affordable than hotels, especially for families or groups. And everything includes insurance, 24/7 support, and roadside assistance. If you're thinking about a summer trip, or just planning ahead for the rest of 2026, get 10% off when you book using promo code OUTDOORSY2026. Head to OUTDOORSY.com. That's OUTDOORSY.com, promo code OUTDOORSY2026.
You didn't really pitch in your drafted season. You went out for a couple appearances. So in that 2024 season, how long until you felt like, oh, I'm kind of a different arm now. Like I'm a different guy in terms of, I mean, again, your numbers in 2024 coming off college season are significantly better than your college numbers. Like how long did it take you to be like, I have comfort with this new repertoire and I feel like I can be dominant with this new repertoire.
Yeah, it was spring training was kind of I performed well, but it was kind of wish-washy as far as like what was performing well each time I went out. Sometimes the heater was just like super flat or not in zone, or sometimes the two seam and the four seam were the exact same pitch and there was just no difference. So like it was kind of took me a little bit in spring training to be like, okay, like this is who I am. Like this is what I have to work with now. It's not just throw four seam 85% of the time. Like I have multiple other options that I can use. And towards the end, I kind of started to, actually figure that out. And, seeing like weak ground balls and swing and misses, that lifted up my confidence quite a bit going into, breaking with Rancho Cucamonga Low A. I was really confident that just like I had enough weapons that, were plus that, I could miss bats when I need to miss bats. I could get swings and, get double plays and get pop-ups whenever I needed to. And, it kind of, only got better, the more that I threw.
So you're one of the few guys I've had on the show that has played exclusively in the minor leagues in the post CBA world. So the quality of life improvements, we've had all the stories of dingy motels and surviving on PB&J and bags of chips and things like that. Like what would you say like your standard of life is like in minor league baseball now?
I mean, I really can't complain about it at all. I mean, we, the team pays for housing. That the housing is extremely nice. Obviously, the Dodgers are top notch as far as the organizations go. Anyway, we have chefs at every affiliate that cook us lunch. That's absolutely amazing. We have a pregame snack that's always very good, and then a large variety of postgame dinners from Taco Tuesdays to steak on Saturdays. I mean, it's super awesome.
If you told a minor leaguer from the 90s that you were getting steak on a Saturday, they might die.
Yeah, I agree. I forget exactly who I was talking to. I think it was one of the other non-roster invites who was a minor league free agent signed this year in big league camp, and I was talking to him about like how Dodger minor leagues work, and they were like, they were extremely jealous to keep it short, but yeah, I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite anecdotes from the show is I was talking to former big leaguer Ty Kelly, who was up with the Orioles And like, it was when Machado was in the minors, and he said that one day Machado bought him a couple bags of chips and he wanted to like cry out of happiness. So that was the food situation back then. And it obviously, it helps you get like not having to spend your money on housing and food and stuff mm-hmm. like that. It probably allows you a higher quality of life. So,
absolutely.
2024, you get bumped up to high A, you're carrying a 3.59 ERA. You're kind of making waves. August 20th, 2024, you know, I'm sure you've had to do this 1,000 times mm-hmm. for listeners who are unfamiliar with your story. Can you walk me through the, I guess from your words, from what I read, a misplaced cutter.
Yeah. It was a cutter that was a little bit too depthy that I left up in the zone, and, you know, really good barrel right back to me, you know, couldn't get a glove up in time. All I knew at that time was that it hurt really bad. You know, like the classic, like get your bell rung, your ears are ringing, all that stuff. At first I thought I was going to be fine. But you know, I like
per all the reporting, you were complaining that you were upset that you had missed your location with the cutter, which is very like baseball dude thing to do.
Yeah. They were, the EMTs were asking me, like, do you know what happened? I was like, yeah, I missed my spot.
Very yeah, baseball guy.
They like, the athletic trainer came out to me and he was, he's like, are you okay? Like, how are you feeling? And I like had finally opened my eyes because I like, obviously my face was just clenching because it hurt very bad. And I saw like, you know, might get a little graphic, like blood running from my nose. And I was like, man, I'm definitely not finishing this game. But yeah, I had to go through lots of, you know, tests and pokes and prods and scans and all that stuff. The final verdict was I had a Lafort 3 fracture, which is a complex of facial fractures. And my globe had been ruptured. So there was like a slit in this eyeball right on the front. So that had to be stitched up. And that caused, obviously, you know, retinal detachment and a traumatic cataract to where I can no longer see out of my right eye.
How long did you wonder if you were going to pitch again?
Surprisingly, probably a day or two. You know, I got phone calls from the farm director and the director of player health telling me, like, whether or not you get vision back, like, we're going to extend everything we can to get your vision back. But even if we can't, you're going to still pitch. Like, we have dealt with somebody who, like multiple people who have only had vision out of one eye and they can do it. So you can do it. And, you know, that gave me, you know, a lot of relief. But as far as pitch to the level in which I had been pitching at, you know, I was a little bit worried about that for a while, maybe like 2 months until I finally like got back onto the mound again. You know, just kind of like feeling my body doing the same thing that I used to do. And, you know, all that stuff. It was just kind of like, well, I hope, I would think that I would still be able to do it. But, you know, obviously going through something that traumatic, there is a little bit of, you know, doubt in the back of my mind. But the first time I got on the mound, I think, was the beginning of December that year. And, you know, it felt absolutely great. Like, I was juiced for like a day and a half. But yeah, like probably that day forward, I was like, yeah, I'm going all in on this. Like, I can definitely do this.
I was going to ask, what was, in terms of rehab, I know you had to endure surgeries and things like that. But from a baseball perspective, shoulders down, you were the exact same guy who was pitching. So was it more dealing with, I assume, adjustments to life and figuring out, how your motor functions are going to work with your new vision and stuff like that? Or were there still baseball hurdles to overcome?
At first I thought that it would only be like, you know, holding runners on second and, you know, fielding PFPs and bunts and stuff like that. Which, you know, I trained pretty extensively in spring training It was like a PFP progression. And I started with like foam balls, having someone like throw them at me and like fielding them, pretending to make a throw first to, doing full on PFPs again, just to make sure that we were covering all of the bases before, I went back into a game or, threw live or anything like that. But as far as, throwing the baseball, I feel that, my visual field kind of affected me more than I had really realized at first. I kind of developed this like low glove side miss that I just like couldn't really understand why I was doing it. It would happen like two, three times in a row, and then I would be like, what is going on? I'd make another pitch and it'd be fine, and I would just kind of forget about it. But it was definitely, something that I just, thought it was, kind of normal. But, now that I think back at it and, have had over a year to, kind of see how this is going, I feel that it's definitely, been a part of the fact that my visual field is skewered from what it has been.
You also, this meant that now when you pitch, you have joined what I call the Tyler Clippard Hall of Fame of dudes who pitch in rec specs, which I always enjoy. How curious going in that, because I just have generally bad vision. So there was a time in college where I thought about pitching glasses or trying stuff on. Like that's an interesting, like you wouldn't think about it if you're just watching a guy on TV, but it's interesting, like having something on your face while you're pitching or changing, like. Was there trial and error in that and deciding, okay, how, when I go back on the mound, like, what am I going to wear? How am I going to wear it? Like, did you try multiple models? Like that fascinates me.
Yeah, I did try. I actually had a handful. I had when I first started baseball stuff, I like immediately got a rather cheap pair on Amazon. Just I'm gonna get this super generic pair and like see what's up. And they were fine. And I tried, like the Flak 2.0s that everyone wears, and I couldn't really like see this way, like the frame was kind of blocking, so I tried the Radar EVs, and I like those a lot. And then I tried out like three or four different like lens shapes with those, just to like what can kind of give me the most protection to make sure nothing traumatic happens again, right? Yeah, right now I'm rocking the Radar EVs, and that's got like an extended lower lens to kind of, keep everything protected a little bit better.
Have this whole ordeal you've been through, are there any like silver linings or things you can point to? I mean, you're free to say no, but like curious, like with now over a year in hindsight, like curious if there's been any sort of perspective or things that you think about differently in regards to your accident.
I mean, for sure, like there is, kind of the main silver lining that has, I've kind of come to terms with is that, I'm able to accomplish a lot more than I ever thought I was going to be able to, for sure. And I think that kind of extends to, every person generally, is that, if you can think it, you can do it. Before I gotten hurt, I never would have thought that I would have been able to pitch and have success with one eye, but, it happened. And then, I kind of had to, and I have now. And, kind of taking that and using it with, everything that happens. Like, I can pitch and succeed in Double A. I can pitch and succeed in Triple A, and I can do it in the big leagues. Just kind of using that, willpower and resilience into, everything that, I have going on.
What did that first high A start feel like?
It was freezing cold in Midland,
Midwest
Michigan.
League. Midwest League in April, baby.
But let me tell you, I was the only one not shivering in that entire stadium, for sure. I was like, from the time that I woke up, I was, just off the walls, like just scratching at the cage, ready to go. I felt absolutely amazing the entire time, for sure.
That you 10 starts in the Midwest League last year, and you struck out 77 in 48 innings, which You know, if you're not versed in baseball stats, pretty good. That's a pretty good ratio. Curious with your, if you look at your scouting reports, it's a lot of swing and miss stuff right now on BA. It's 3+ pitches, but the caveat of like needing to throw more strikes. How do you kind of marry that in your mind of like, you're a guy, you can blow guys away with your stuff. You can break bats, you can create soft contact, things like that. But also this, you know, need presumably to be in the zone a little bit more, or giving guys fewer free passes. I mean, the strikeouts help. It doesn't matter if you walk two guys, if you strike out the next three, but like, curious how you marry the idea of continuing to harness all this stuff, but trying to fill up the zone more.
Right. I mean, it's, you kind of have to have a little bit of a tough conversation with yourself. I know I have, to where, you know I have this good stuff. I know it can get swing and miss. And, you know, I get to a point where I have to set that aside. Be like, okay, I know I have this stuff and I know it can be good, but, you know, I need to focus on this, which is, you know, putting the ball in the zone. And, you know, my mindset mentality when I'm on the mound now in spring training games is like, race to two strikes. Like, how fast can I put two in the box, or like get you to foul two off, you know, whatever it is. How fast can I get the two strikes to where once I get you to 0-2, 1-2, you now have a very low chance of getting on base. Like, you're going to get this very good swing and miss stuff, and, you know, good luck.
Would you say that race to two strikes, is it mechanical? Is it more mechanical or more mental in terms of how you approach it?
I think it's definitely more mental. You know, obviously if your mechanics are a little bit out of whack, you're going to have, you know, more struggle being in the zone consistently. But, you know, if you go into the game thinking about your mechanics, you're probably not in a great spot. Yeah, I've definitely done it before and I was not in a great spot. You know, I was way more worried about, you know, where my glove arm was, how high my leg was getting, like all this stuff, rather than just like getting the guy out. And it just didn't feel great. It didn't feel like I was competing, you know? But now it's just mental. Like, I'm getting you to two strikes. I'm going to get you on your heels. And then, sorry about it.
Last year, you made that jump to AA for the first time. What is often, you know, often called the toughest jump besides the one from AAA to the big leagues? What did you notice from AA hitters that were different than high A hitters? Like, how they attacked you, how they spit on pitches, how they jumped on mistakes. Like, what were the things that jumped out to you?
There's definitely, the overall approach, first of all, is a lot better. It's a lot more sound. And AA hitters are a lot better at, kind of not chasing. So like, you know, if I go 2-0, then, you know, they know something hard's coming. So they're, you know, they're only looking for that something hard. And then, you know, I go through the lineup one time, they see that, you know, my slider or my curveball isn't in zone as much as I wanted to. And then I keep falling behind, you know, they know something's hard's coming. And I, you know, just would get pigeonholed into, you know, giving up a barrel. That's kind of one of the things that I've been really focusing on, is like off speed in zone as well. And, you know, there had been a number of times where I would get somebody 0-2, 1-2, and then, you know, I'd throw a slider or a curveball and it would kind of like pop a little early and it would end be in zone. And then, you know, I'd give up a single, where in, you know, high A, it might've been like a rollover, or, you know, still even a swing and miss, or maybe even, you know, no swing at all.
In college, you might face a dude max two times a season. If you pitch against him in the regular season, pitch him in this conference tournament or something like that. By the end of a minor league season, I mean, it's kind of different if you jump levels like you have, but if it's an in-division team, you might end up facing a hitter 10 to 15 times, 10 to 15 ABs or so over the course of a season. Not asking you to give away trade secrets or anything, but if you're facing a guy that much and they're digging into the box against you that much, how do you approach that in terms of, like, you know what you do well, you have the summation of these first five at bats, is it continuing to bury weaknesses, or do you feel like you're always kind of with the approach that these higher level hitters have, are you always trying to surprise them in some way?
I mean, there's a lot of kind of a lot of give and take. You know, if I kind of go deep into a game earlier in the season and, you know, face somebody, you know, three times in one game, and then, you know, 4 or 5 weeks later, the same guy gets into the box, like, I feel like I should know as a starting pitcher, you know, what pitches he was on, what pitches he wasn't on. And, you know, he as a hitter should know, you know, what pitches he should be looking for and what pitches, like, got him out, like, he struggled with, to, you know, be aware of and looking for it out of hand to, you know, kind of just either fight it off or, you know, slap something the other way. So it kind of is like a give and take, to where, you know, maybe you have to give up a hit to know that, you know, okay, this guy was looking for that pitch. So now I know he's not going to get it first pitch next AB.
Do minor league starters, do you still have to go into the stands and chart, or is it all just data driven now?
No, it's all
I'm old.
It's all, you know, video and TrackMan and Hawkeye and all that stuff now.
Man, you've missed out on being the guy in street clothes at the concourse ordering chicken fingers and charting in the minors.
Yeah, there are definitely some instances where I would think that might be pretty fun. You know, I think about playing at the Dayton Dragons. I feel like that'd be sick to be in the stands and just hang out on the day you're not pitching.
Yeah, you might have just answered one of my rapid fire questions at the end. But I've heard good things about playing with Dayton. No, you might be too young to remember Kyle Zimmer, who I think was the fifth overall pick with the Royals. But I was interning for the Red Sox High A team in college, and it was middle of the game, and I was walking to the concourse or something, and he was just sitting at a table in street clothes charting, and I was like, that guy just signed for like $5 million, and he's just sitting in a, like, a half empty minor league stadium charting pitches in the seventh inning of a Carolina League game.
Yeah, the minor leagues are awesome, man.
It's nothing like it. So we're about to break for camp. You said before we started recording, you're not sure where you're going, but what are your high level goals for 2026?
I mean, just, you know, right now my main goal is to, you know, to start off first outing, you know, start off extremely well, and then just continue to build, stack up as many, you know, good outings as possible, and, you know, take the positives and, you know, carry them in my backpack and ride them all the way. And, you know, whatever negatives there are each week, just, you know, try to nip them in the bud, you know, make sure nothing becomes overgrown and ends up a lingering problem later in the year.
Well, I will be rooting for you unless you face my beloved Minnesota Twins, but I got a quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
Sweet. Let's do it.
Favorite minor league ballpark.
The Dragons ballpark is definitely the best atmosphere. I'll say that for sure.
Like, legendary minor league atmosphere at this point. No one really does it like that, especially in the low minors. Favorite college ballpark. I would say favorite away ballpark.
Coastal Carolinas Park.
That's a good choice. How often do you get asked if you play basketball?
Probably every time I go to the grocery store, I would say.
I figured it was high.
Yeah, once or twice a week. You know, I help somebody pull something down from the top shelf, and they ask me if I play basketball. I have to explain the whole thing to them. But yeah, it's pretty often.
What is your favorite Marshall food spot?
We had a Chick-fil-A in the student center that literally every single underclassman would go to after practice every single day.
What about a local joint? Is there, like, someone's going to visit Huntington, where would you tell them?
I would say you'd have to go to Fat Patty's.
Describe it to me. I need more than that.
It's, hometown small hometown bar feel. They've got, you know, a whole bunch of wings and a whole bunch of burgers and, you know, just kind of, you know, good old classic American food.
I'm sold. Sounds great. last one. Everyone gets this, and this might be a question that has aged out of guys playing in this day and age. But do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
I've got I do. I have two. The first one is kind of simple. It's just that last year we had a double roadie, and we went from Tulsa to Midland, Texas, and then Midland, Texas to Corpus Christi, and then Corpus Christi through the night to Tulsa. We got there. We left Corpus at like 8 or 9 at night, and we got there, got to Tulsa at like 10 a.m.
Texas League is the most brutal for road trips. There's nothing like it.
But the kind of like a brutal story. This was in 20 beginning of 2024. We were doing a double roadie. We went to Modesto the first week, and then to Visalia the second week. And after we had finished playing against Visalia, we were driving home, and we'd had the same bus the entire time, and the bathroom in the back hadn't been like cleaned out. So it was just a awful smell. And there was it was extremely hot. It was like 95 degrees. And guys had like wrapped hoodies around their face and put like air freshener in their hoodie that had wrapped around their face just to like not endure the smell for any longer. But yeah, it was pretty terrible.
That's a pretty good welcome to the minor leagues moment as well.
Yeah,
That's
I would we endured it for like at least 4 hours, and it still had the same effect from the time we got on to the time we got off, and there was no going nose blind to it at all.
that's a nightmare. I can't think of anything better to end this one on. Pat,
Thank
I'm rooting for you. Thank you so much for joining from Feed on the Farm.
you for having me on, Kyle. I appreciate it.
You got it. And that's it for today's episode. Big thanks to Pat Copen for stopping by, walking us through his journey thus far. Looking forward to seeing what he does this season. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we'll be back in another month. Thanks for listening.